she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. I have some special people I want you to talk to today. And we're going to kick it off with somebody I met just a few weeks ago when I was on a trip to Tucson. And I think I may have mentioned that I was in Tucson looking at some technology. And I had dinner with a group of really interesting people. And really, right at the top of it was this guy named Jay Dobbins. And Jay has just led the most interesting life. He has just completed a 27, I think, year tour of duty with ATF, where he was an undercover agent all over the country, helping to root out really awful souls, I gotta say. And he struck me at this dinner as having the most courage of anybody I have met in a very, very long time. And it's a different kind of courage than somebody who's facing cancer and somebody who's doing all these other things in life. And I get that. But this kind of in-your-face-with-evil courage, I thought, offered some lessons for all of us. Whether we are building businesses or facing financial fears, you sometimes need to have such a deep level of courage. So I invited Jay to join me today. Jay, welcome to the Elise Glink Show.
Thanks for having me, and hello to your audience.
It's nice to have you here. You can find more about Jay at his website, Jay Dobbins, JayDobbins.com, and of course we'll put it in today's show notes. So, Jay, how did you get involved with the ATF at the beginning of your career?
Well, you know, when I came out of college, I played football for a little bit, and when I was looking to figure out what my profession was going to be, I wanted to do something that when the alarm clock went off in the morning, when I put my feet on the ground, I really felt good about what I was doing. I wanted to contribute to society. I wanted to make a positive impact. I was never a money guy. I never made my personal decisions based on money, how much money I would make or what the potential was there. And so it just kind of naturally evolved that I became a law enforcement officer. And it served all those needs that I was personally inside me looking for.
Well, you've written an amazing book that I recommend highly called No Angel, My Harrowing Undercover Journey to the Inner Circle of the Hell's Angels. And when I met you, I mean, I can understand how you would fit right in. I mean, you have this kind of biker look to you with, you know, just, I don't know, the tattoos and the way you're built and the way you kind of walk around. And yet, I thought you were one of the nicest people I've met also in a very long time. And so how did you separate out who you are personally from who you had to be to get into the Hell's Angels? And then what you did is, of course, you brought like half of them down for all the drug running and gun running or whatever else they were doing. But how did you find that deep inside yourself?
Well, you know, it's really difficult to do, and it's perilous internally. It's perilous to your psyche and to your mentality to live those two different lives. And I think it's described, you know, in my book, in that I actually failed in that because I became so wrapped up into my undercover role that I put a great amount of personal damage, you know, on my family. It's the job, that job working undercover, it can't be treated as a hobby. You go all in because it is a life and death situation. It's not something that you can dabble in. People that dabble in undercover work get killed. You have to jump in and not dip your toe in the pond. You have to go underwater and become that person. And when you do that, there's huge sacrifices that are made, and it impacts people not necessarily involved in the case, but who care about you and who are a part of your life.
So when you do that, again, I go back to this idea of courage, because facing the, you must have known in your heart that you were doing some damage to your wife and to your children. And I've met your wife, you guys have been married a very long time, for 25 years, just like Sam and I have. She's just an amazing woman. And, you know, listening to the two of you talk about this story at dinner and how you both had to find some really significant amount of courage and fortitude, right? Strength of character and strength of relationship to sort of soldier through this. I think it's just really instructive. And I get what you're saying, that there's no way to just be kind of pregnant here, right? You're all in, or you're not all in.
I'll tell you what, and this is a very, this is a humiliating statement to make about myself, but I try to be very honest when I look at myself and I assess myself. And so this is not a flattering statement to make, but nonetheless, it's the truth. When I was in that role, I abandoned my family. And I abandoned them for what, at that time, in my mind, I felt was the mission, was the greater good, was my service to America, to my community. And I turned my back on my family at that point because I was doing such a bad job of trying to play both sides of the fence. And I knew that I had to make a choice. I had to go in, all in one way or the other. And in hindsight, in retrospect, that's my biggest regret, is that I voluntarily sacrificed my family for what I believed was, you know, a greater good mission. And in the end, I really hurt the people that loved me and that cared about me. And thank goodness that, you know, my wife is the woman that she is, and my family are the people that they are, because they're the ones that saved us. They're the ones that saved this family and saved me, not anything I did.
How do you, when you're dealing with something like this, that's just, you know, an insurmountable thing, and truly, this book is amazing, folks. If you're listening at home, we're talking with Jay Dobbins. He is a former ATF agent of 27 years and wrote this incredible book called No Angel, My Harrowing Undercover Journey to the Inner Circle of the Hell's Angels. And you can find it online at Amazon, or you can just go to Jay Dobbins, JayDobbins.com. When you're talking to people and you're giving, you know, many speeches that you give around the country, you know, the idea of courage and facing fears comes up, and there must have been a harrowing moment for you, or many moments, when you just thought, I don't know how I'm going to put one foot in front of the other tomorrow or the minute that this ends. Why don't you describe one of those moments and how you actually were able to keep going?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I think that Hollywood and the media and television and magazines and books, they, as an audience, as a society, they betray us, because they, those entities define for us in the media what we think courage is, or what it looks like, or what it's supposed to be. And that is the case, but it's not always the case, and it's not the case for the populace. You know, traditionally we associate courage with soldiers and men and women in battle, but courage really comes down to, in my layman's, you know, blue-collar view of it, it's betting on yourself. Do you have the courage and the faith and the confidence to take all your chips and push them to the middle of the table and bet on you? And that's what I did. I was faced with some pretty good obstacles, and I just bet on myself. And I think that that is the courage that's in all of us. But not all of us are given the opportunities to test that or to define it.
I think that's such a great point. I always talk on the show about, and in my books, about how any person can do about 95% of everything they need to do with their money by themselves. Because nobody, when you look in the mirror, nobody really cares about your money or your finances as much as you do. Because nobody has done without, right? Nobody missed time with family for it but you. And nobody, you know, worked on a Saturday and Sunday and at night except you. And nobody changed jobs and lost sleep over it and except you. And so it all really comes down when you're facing something like a huge financial challenge, which so many of my listeners have faced over the last 7-8 years. It all comes down to who you are and the resourcefulness that you've been able to develop and the strength of character that you have. And I think I hear you saying exactly that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think courage shows itself when we're confronted with something that makes us uncomfortable. And it doesn't have to be, you know, in the middle of a gunfight. It happens every day. It happens in relationships. It happens in our jobs. It happens with our finances. When someone that we care about or when we ourselves get sick, all those things bring out and give us an opportunity to show what our courage is. But I don't care if you're a soldier in the middle of a gunfight in Afghanistan, or if you're you run a business, or you're balancing your checkbook. Problems and situations are confronted, and it still comes back to my earlier point. Are you willing to bet on yourself? Do you have the faith in yourself to go all in and use logic and reason and common sense to assess where you're at, and then bet on yourself and go for it? It's hard for people to do that. It's hard for people to go all in because inherently we assess risk. We do risk assessment, and it's risky. And to what level of courage or to what level of courage you want to let out ultimately defines who we are.
That's a great point. I'm talking with Jay Dobbins. Jay is a former ATF agent of 27 years. He just retired a couple of weeks ago. We're probably getting his first post-ATF career interview, which is very exciting. He's the author of an international bestseller called No Angel, My Harrowing Undercover Journey to the Inner Circle of Hell's Angels. It is a spectacular story, and Jay has a lot to share. Jay, when we come back, will you describe, we have to take a quick break, but I'd love for you to describe a really scary moment. Maybe when, someone blew up your house, and how that, the intersection of that with your personal life, and I know that that was a very scary time for you. I'm Elise Klink. This is Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinklink.com and find Elise Klink live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750. News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Klink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. I'll be tweeting out all kinds of links for the show, and of course, we're pushing out right now the link for jaydobbins.com, J-A-Y-D-O-B-Y-N-S.com. Jay is my guest this morning, the author of the international bestseller, No Angel, My Harrowing Undercover Journey to the Inner Circle of Hell's Angels, and it's an absolute must-read New York Times international bestseller. So, Jay, I kind of referenced this before we went to break. I know when I was at dinner, you and your wife were both telling me about maybe the scariest thing, which is when your business life of being a Hell's Angel undercover agent crossed over into your personal life, and someone actually bombed the house your wife and sons were in.
Well, when you do what I do for a living, when you befriend people, and you gain their loyalty, and you gain their trust, and then ultimately you betray that. I betrayed them because I wasn't who I pretended to be. And then they found out who I really was. When you're doing that with very violent people, you create a huge amount of animosity in a world that is willing to act on that. And so ultimately, at the end of my case, I received an enormous amount of death and violence threats, which, you know, the most significant was that my house was burned down with my family inside. You know, fortunately, they escaped, you know, without significant injury. But, you know, on our theme of courage, when something like that real touches your personal life, touches your family, you're confronted with fear and with pain and with danger and uncertainty and intimidation. And then that gives you the opportunity to show you know, physical courage to stand up to it physically, and also moral courage. Like, how do you act? How do you respond to this? So, as tragic as that was for me, I ultimately viewed it as an opportunity to demonstrate to my family, to my kids, bad things are going to happen to you. Troubled times are going to come. How do you react to it? What do you do about it? What is your response? And hopefully my reaction and response to that will set the stage and the standard for my kids in the future. So when those types of situations, regardless of where they may be, come into their lives.
Which is an amazing gift to be able to give to them. Jay, thank you so much for being with us today.
I enjoyed it. All the best to you, and thank you to your audience, and enjoy the rest of your show.
Thank you. Jay, you can find Jay at jaydobyns.com, jaydobyns.com, and pick up a copy of his book, No Angel. It is just incredible. I'm Elise Klink. Stay tuned. We've got a lot more coming up today on News Talk WSB. Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Klink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, so you get everybody's links and information for today's show. And you're going to want it. Trust me. I have Adam Bryant with me. You can find him online at adambryantbooks.com. Adam is a columnist for the New York Times business section, and I was just telling him as we were getting ready to go on the air that I read his column first. It's on the inside page of the business section when you open it up, and it's the interviews with all of the CEOs. And I wanted to invite him on because, as you know, we promised at the beginning of the year new tools, new thinking about how to build your small business as well as how to set yourself right financially. Now that we're moving out of the Great Recession and into something better, I hope, I thought some new tools would be appropriate now. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Elise.
So what led you to write the book Quick and Nimble? What were you thinking?
Well, I've interviewed about 300 CEOs and other leaders by now, and one CEO said something that really stayed with me. He said, we want to be the largest small company in our space. And by that, he, of course, meant largest by size, profits, revenue, but small in terms of culture, and how do you hold on to that startup feel? And that really kind of grabbed my attention, and I found myself thinking it was like a puzzle. Well, what is culture, and how do you do that, and what are the biggest drivers of culture? So that's, culture is such a fuzzy, amorphous word. I mean, if you and I stood in front of a whiteboard and said, what's culture? We could put 100 things on it, and
right,
all of them would be true. So the real trick is trying to figure out, well, what are the biggest drivers of culture, and what are the things that are really important to hold on to that startup feel?
So you interview a lot of technology companies in the book, and I would have to say, I mean, I didn't do an action. I looked at the list of the CEOs who were interviewed and where they were at the time, and you acknowledge people move on and go to different things. But it seems like technology is really a very big part of this book, and I know it's such a fast-growing culture in and of itself. And it's interesting to see how the lessons of Silicon Valley and, like, free food and, you know, transportation, and you look at Google and what they're providing and how other companies are trying to attract that same kind of talent, and they're creating things. And so one of the lessons that I've taken from the part of the book that I was looking at is this idea that we've really become so much more employee-centric. And truly, in my own small business, ThinkLink Media, that is the case. You know, it's really about finding the right employees and then keeping them as happy as I can possibly make them, given that they're working, not playing.
That's exactly right. And one of the reasons why I interview so many tech CEOs is that I think we're getting a glimpse of the future in Silicon Valley in terms of how people think about culture. Because what I've come to appreciate is that if you are a tech CEO, a couple of your main jobs and responsibilities, excuse me, one is to hire talented software developers and coders, because there's a supply and demand problem out in the valley. So you've got to, you know, you got to recruit them. And then the second challenge is to hold on to them, because those people, once they're working for you, are getting headhunted every single day. And that creates such a premium on being really thoughtful about culture and creating an environment where people want to stay every day. And so that's why, and again, tech CEOs, they often think outside the box and have come up with a lot of very creative approaches to create that culture, to do just like you're doing. You know, I've got these great people. I need to hold on to them. I want them to come to work every day, as opposed to feel like, oh, no, I've got to go to work.
What are some of the tips that your CEOs have shared? How do they, give us a couple of them so that we have a sense of, you know, are we on the right path or not? It would be great, actually, if you created a little online tool so we could compare our own, you know, cultures to really, really successful big, small businesses. But what are some tips that you've heard?
A couple of them actually operate at a very human level, because I do think culture is really just about the relationships between people and organization. And I think cultures, great cultures, are really built on those relationships. People know how to work together. So, again, at a very human level, I have a chapter called Adult Conversations, which is really just underscoring the importance of having direct and candid discussions with your colleagues, and for managers to do that with their employees. Because the default in most organizations is that if there is a problem, if there's a point of friction, that people just kind of sweep it under the rug and they say, well, that was just once, maybe they'll, you know, maybe they're having a bad day, and then a second time it happens, they go, well, I'll talk about the next week because this is a really busy week, and then suddenly it's 9 months later and they're bringing it up in a performance review. And these conversations are stressful. I mean, I often say they're like stepping into a knife fight in a phone booth, and that you don't know how people are going to react, so you do avoid them. But I've just heard from so many CEOs that these conversations are so important. If there are points of disagreement, to air them out. And then when you do it, it sort of releases a lot of energy that can be in an organization. I mean, we've all experienced that in our personal relationships, right, with family members and the
sure.
like. Another really key point around communication, I have a chapter called The Hazards of Email, because even though email was created...
Chris Christie has learned that lesson, yes?
Exactly.
Again?
Exactly. But it's funny, because even though email was created as this wonderful productivity tool, I've come to appreciate that it can be incredibly damaging to culture. And it's really for a reason that one CEO told me. He said, things get lost in translation
for
email. And, you know, you can't convey tone, and it's so easy for people to misread what you intend, and it just can be very damaging. I mean, what I've come to appreciate is that email does literally nothing to build the connective tissue of relationships between colleagues, and in fact is more likely to damage what connective tissue is there in the first place. And I've just heard from so many CEOs where they take really active steps to send a message of, you know, email might be fine for just really simple transactional stuff, you know, where do you want to go out for lunch? But for anything where the stakes are high, it's important to pick up the phone, walk down the hallway, get on Skype, because this is the irony that even though email is a productivity tool, you can often chew up a whole afternoon because of some disagreement you have with somebody over email. But if you were to talk to them in person, you can resolve it in 30 seconds and high-five each other and walk away.
Right. And, you know, that's actually a really excellent point, because when you think about productivity, you know, people are so used to email now.
Yeah.
Right. And it's such a fallback for everybody on, well, I did it on email. But, you know, I was having this conversation with the guy who runs our editorial group at my company, and we were saying how just simply walking to the other side of the office and annoying is probably too strong a word, but you're like poking everybody. What are you doing? What are you hanging out with? Or, you know, we try to have team lunches and we try to build the connective tissue. It's one of the reasons why we really don't encourage people to work from home. We want them in the office.
Yep.
Marissa Mayer, hello. But you do. You build that connective tissue, whereas when email is just so linear, it's very flat, it's black and white, and it's really hard to make people understand what goes on behind the scenes.
And I think the temptation, especially, you know, our computer screens are getting bigger and bigger, and our cubicles are becoming like our caves, you know.
Right.
And it's easy to just sort of hide in there and interact with people through our screens, and we've got all these tabs open, and there's GChat and Twitter and Facebook, but we just have to always remember that it's the human interaction, and you've got to force yourself to get up and walk down the hall and go talk to people. And a lot of CEOs I've interviewed have very explicit rules, like, you know, they tell their employees that if you CC me on an email, I promise you I will not read it, because they understand that a lot of people just CC the boss to cover themselves, and
right.
he wants them to interact with each other and take ownership of what they're doing. And another CEO said, if you are going to email me, if the message is longer than my iPhone screen, I will not read it.
So they want you to be, you know,
concise.
Coherent and...
Yeah. And concise.
Concise. And
yeah.
So it's true. Well, time is... It's really interesting. Time is at such a premium right now. And I know for myself, I travel a lot for work. And there's so many commitments that if you have just a day and a half in the office, like, you know, this week. This is a very typical week. I'm traveling three and a half out of the 4 days
mm-hmm.
or 5 days. And you have such a limited amount of time that you really want to make the most of it when you are there. And many CEOs do travel, and they're not there with their people every day. And so talk for a moment just about the importance of hiring And some of the great, because that's truly one of the great things about your column is you got CEOs and you talk about how you're hiring and what you're thinking about when you're hiring and why do you hire the way you hire. And usually there's a long and detailed, thoughtful answer behind that.
Yeah, the CEOs have a challenge because by the time somebody gets to them in a job interview, that person has probably been coached and trained and, you know, they know the scripts for the right answers. You've probably heard them yourself. What's my greatest weakness? I care too much. I work too hard. Things like that. So the CEOs have to become almost master psychologists and develop what I call bank shot questions, which is how do you get around the facade these people present to find out what they're really like. And a lot of a big part of what they're looking for is self-awareness. They want people to understand how they come across, and which makes a lot of sense because the way work is being increasingly done is people to get together in, you know, teams for quick projects from across disciplines, and they disband. And you've probably seen it yourself, Lisa, that, you know, if one person among four on a small team doesn't really know how to read the room and isn't really aware of how they come across, it can really throw off the dynamic. So many things come back to self-awareness. And some of the surprising questions I've heard are, you know, Tony Hsieh at Zappos asked people on a scale of 1 to 10, how weird are you?
Did he hire the tens or the ones?
I think if you do the extremes at either end, he wants to drill down. But I think it's a clever question because first it acknowledges that we are all weird, right, at some level. And also it's a signal to people that Zappos culture is weird and we want you to bring your weirdness to us. He asks another interesting question. He says to people, tell me what the biggest misperception that people have about you is. And it turns out that's just a setup. So after you answer that, then he comes in with, well, what's the difference between perception and misperception? Mm-hmm. And again, just getting at self-awareness. So I just think that's such
a... It's great. I mean, what can you say? It's a terrific question that now I'm going to steal and ask to everybody else that comes through my door. We're talking with Adam Bryant. He conducts interviews with chief executives for Corner Office. That's the feature on the inside cover page of the New York Times business section on Sunday, which is fantastic. It's now Friday and Sunday, right?
Exactly.
Which is fantastic. His new book, Quick and Nimble, Lessons from Leading CEOs and How to Create a Culture of Innovation, has just been published. It's terrific. I'm about a little better than halfway through, and I can't wait to finish reading it. You can find him online at adambryantbooks.com, adambryantbooks.com. Adam, stick around. We can do another minute or two when we come back.
That's great. Thanks.
All right. Stay tuned. This is the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. Don't forget to go to my Twitter feed, at Glink, at GLINK, for links to everybody who's a guest today. We're talking with Adam Bryant. He writes the Corner Office feature Fridays and Sundays in the New York Times, and he's written a new book called Quick and Nimble, Lessons from Leading CEOs on How to Create a Culture of Innovation. All right, got to communicate quickly here because we only have about a minute and a half left, Adam, but what is your favorite lesson on communication?
It's really important for leaders in any organization to understand the truth of the cliche that there is no such thing as over-communication. I've heard from so many CEOs, they say that when they first become leaders, they feel like they're repeating themselves over and over at all-hands meetings and group meetings about the strategy and the mission, but they understand over time that they have to do that, because the key insight for me is that you're battling the void. Because if you leave a void of communication, just human nature kicks in. People start filling it with all sorts of rumors and conjecture about what's really happening at the company. So again, key lesson: there's no such thing as over communication.
Oh, you mean like the game telephone? Not that ever happens in my office.
Not
Adam,
at all.
Adam, thank you so much for being with us today. Go to Adam Bryant. books.com. Bryant is spelled B-R-Y-A-N-T, or better yet, go to my Twitter feed at Glink, or go to today's show notes and we will link you to everybody. Adam, thanks again.
Thanks so much, Elise.
Good luck with the book. It's really terrific. Quick and Nimble, Lessons from Leading CEOs and How to Create a Culture of Innovation. I'm Elise Glink. Stand by. We'll be back in a moment with more on News Talk WSB.
Sunday, Elise Glink is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions. Only on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Welcome back. back, everybody, to the Elise Glenn Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter. Everything's getting pushed out there, and then the show notes are up at thinklink.com. And sign up for the free weekly newsletter while you're there. If you are interested in investing in real estate, visit thinklinkstore.com. That is the place you can buy all of our stuff. And if you want a 25% discount, use the discount code WSB. We're going to switch tacks right now, and we're going to talk to Darren Blomquist. He is a vice president with Realty Track. So when I tell you all of the numbers about the number of foreclosures nationwide and the top 10 states for foreclosures and the underwater homeowners and who's buying with cash and who's using a mortgage, those numbers, a lot of them come from Realty Track. And it has just been a powerhouse of data about the industry, about real estate and about investing. That's sort of the business behind that. And so I've asked Darren to come on so we can talk a little bit about the current real estate market and what's going on. I think some of these numbers will surprise you and maybe trends for the rest of 2014 as far as foreclosures go. Darren, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Elise. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. So let's start with underwater homeowners. When we were talking during the break before you came on the air, you gave me a number of underwater homeowners that I think is still really stark and surprising. How many people are still underwater with their mortgages, where their house is worth less than the mortgage amount?
Well, we're showing that there's still 9.3 million homeowners nationwide with a mortgage that's at least 25% more than what the property is worth. So we're not just talking about people who maybe are just barely underwater, but these are deeply underwater folks who it's going to take at least months, probably years, for them to regain the equity in their homes. That 9.3 million represents 19% of all homeowners nationwide with a mortgage. There's about 50 million homeowners with a mortgage nationwide.
So that's just a startling number, and a lot of those people live in Atlanta because we know that still there, while some pockets have recovered and prices have gone up, it was such a deep hole to begin with here in Atlanta, and then you had places like Phoenix and Las Vegas and, oh, heck, the entire state of Michigan, Chicago, the usual suspects, right?
That's right. I mean, in those states and in those metros, some of those that you've mentioned, we're seeing underwater percentages as close to 40, even close to 50%. Las Vegas is the very top one at right at 50%. And these are numbers all of as of the end of 2013. And so some of those, many of those markets that had the bigger bubble, bigger home price increase and then following decrease, is where we see still the most homeowners, the highest percentage of homeowners left underwater. And it's going to take the longest in many cases for those homeowners to get out of that negative equity position. And I really think that's probably the biggest risk to the housing market right now, is that these folks are out there. And right now, the vast majority of them, the good news, the vast majority of them are making their payments, continuing to do that and not falling into foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, if there's some other trigger, these folks are much higher risk to fall into foreclosure. And the other thing is, I think there's some of these people who it's just after a while they're going to give up and walk away because it's taking so long, and the end may never feel like it's going to be in sight for them to regain their equity.
It's actually a good point. I think for a while we were imagining that home prices were zooming up so quickly that a lot of these people came out from underwater. And that is true, but in these sort of deeply distressed markets like Atlanta, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Michigan, Chicago, and there are a few others as well, it does feel like those home prices that were zooming last year, maybe even in part of 2012, have now plateaued. And so even in places like Atlanta, you still may see some upward momentum, but it's not going to be up 25%.
That's right, and we do expect home prices to continue to moderate home price appreciation, which is a good thing. I mean, if home prices continue to increase in some of these markets as fast as they did in 2013 when we saw a nice bounce off the bottom, we'll be hitting bubble territory again very quickly. And so we want to see home prices moderate, but the bad news for these underwater borrowers is that's going to mean it's a longer road to get back to positive equity in some of these markets, and it's gonna be a matter of years rather than even months for a lot of these folks who are underwater. On the positive side, this number is going down, as you referred to. That 9.3 million is down from actually just earlier in the year was over 10 million. So we've come down pretty dramatically, even within 2013.
Is that because of short sales and banks finally getting with the program, or is this because in a lot of other markets where people were not that far underwater, going up 12, 15, 20% in value has helped them get above the threshold?
Yes, I think it's a little bit of a combination of both, that we did see a surge in short sales, especially early in 2013,
mm-hmm.
and that effectively got people out from underwater because their mortgage was extinguished through that short sale, and so they were no longer underwater. And then we did see banks a little bit more open because of the national mortgage settlement to principal balance reductions. And then, of course, the rising home prices. Certainly there's a group of folks who are not as deeply underwater, and so that pushed them over the line and got them into positive equity. But when we actually look deeper into the numbers, the biggest segment of those 9.3 million, over 5 million of them have a loan-to-value ratio of at least 150%.
Wow.
And so that means they're even deeper underwater than just, you know, an LTV of 125%, which was the minimum threshold. So there's this group of homeowners who are just really entrenched and in a deep hole there. And I think it's going to be tough for them. I think we may see some changes with the new head of the FHFA coming in and being open to principal balance reductions for Fannie and Freddie loans.
Mm-hmm.
That could be a bit of a game changer in 2014 if we see that actually take place.
Well, balance reductions have been something that's on the administration's list for a long time, and it's not taxpayers who are taking that. It's typically it's the lenders taking that. So, anyway.
Yeah, for the Fannie and Freddie back loans, it's the lenders who have to still agree to that. But the previous head of Fannie and Freddie was in principle, not to use a pun there, was opposed to those reductions. The new head there, Mel Watt, seems to be open to that.
Yeah, Mel comes from a very different place in a very different community.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about what you see happening, though, overall over the course of the year. I mean, certainly we're going to see foreclosures continue to decline. They've declined quite a lot. Short sales, I think there could be more, but maybe not at the rate that we were seeing.
Mm.
The people that I talk to, you know, who really know something about this as well, they think maybe we've got another 2 years to go before we've fully washed most of the foreclosures and short sales and delinquency out of the system. What do you think?
Yes, I actually think that's probably a pretty good estimate. In terms of foreclosures specifically, we're on a trajectory to get back to normal foreclosure levels by the beginning of 2015, so that's less than that two-year window.
Mm-hmm.
We were at the lowest level, 1.4 million homes with a foreclosure notice in 2013. That was the lowest level since 2007, when there were 1.3 million. And so we're very much on our way to getting back to what we would call normal levels of foreclosure activity.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the end of it. There's still a lot of people in distress beyond those that are actually entering foreclosure, and in part that's because there's been such a reaction to foreclosures, and it's very much politically considered bad to and from the banks it's a bad PR to have more foreclosures, and so there have been some other avenues that these distressed properties are taking rather than foreclosure. One of them is short sale, and we did see short sales up to more than 250,000 in 2013, which was above the level we saw in 2012.
250 or 150?
250,000.
Wow.
Yeah, and that includes both properties in foreclosure and not in foreclosure. In fact, the somewhat surprising, there was a bigger number of short sales on homes not in foreclosure in 2013 than those in the process. And so that was interesting to see that the banks, in, at least in some cases, are willing to cut their losses and not have to deal with the bad PR, honestly, and also just the the cost of going through foreclosure.
Yeah, going through foreclosure doesn't, as I keep saying on the show, the banks don't like it either. I mean, it really just, you know,
right.
It doesn't like it. So.
Especially with some of the new regulations in some of these states that have taken place. I mean, I think the Homeowner Bill of Rights in California, and then we saw Nevada basically carbon copy that took place in 2013, has made it much less palatable, even though it was before, for the banks to proceed with foreclosure. So they're dealing with these properties to a certain extent in other ways, and it is, we'll see foreclosure levels back to normal, but that doesn't mean the market's completely back.
All right, we know the market's not coming back. I mean, we can just see that in the new home construction numbers, which are still like at 50% of where they should be, which is completely crazy. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Darren Blomquist. He's a Realty Track vice president. Realty Track does a huge amount in numbers and statistics in the industry, and they provide a lot of information for investors. And you can find them at realtytrack.com. Darren, will you stick around? I want to just quickly, we'll have a couple of minutes when we come back, but I want to ask you about the number of cash buyers out there and what you think that means going forward to the real estate market, all right?
All right, sounds good.
Okay, I'm Elise Glink. We are Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Don't forget, we've got full show notes up at thinklink.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter. Go to thinklinkstore.com and check out my Intentional Investor Series, 9 webinars, 9 ebooks, one low price. I have Darren Blomquist with me right now. He's a vice president with Realty Track. They do a ton of statistics about the real estate market and what's going on. Darren, cash buyers, what level are they at right now? What percentage of total number of buyers are buying without a mortgage? And what do you think that says about where we are in the real estate cycle?
Yes, and I think this number is going to really surprise a lot of people, and we honestly hardly believed it, but we dug into the data and have verified it. But as of December, which is the latest data we have, 42% of all residential transactions that took place during the month of December were all cash purchases. And we look,
wow,
when we look at some of the markets, it's over 60%. South Florida, maybe not surprisingly, is the hottest spot. Places like Cape Coral and Miami, over.
What does
60%.
It mean?
Well, it means that we have, I mean, on one hand, it's a good sign that there's a lot of confidence in this market, and that a lot of people think real estate is underpriced enough. They're willing to put their own money, their money where their mouth is, and not just rely on other people's money to buy this real estate. But I don't think it's healthy for the long term, because we don't want the market to be, founded on cash buyers. We want the market recovery ultimately to have a broader foundation in terms of having first-time home buyers participating at a higher level, who are typically going to be requiring financing, and as well as move-up buyers using financing and also relying on the equity.
So what are you saying? The piggy investors are stepping in with their cash and they're kicking out the first-time buyers who still need financing. I keep hearing from people that that's what they're seeing.
Yeah, it's leaving some of those buyers out in the cold.
Yeah.
And
they're not piggy, by the way. You know, I love investors, and I've written books and e-books for them. But what's happening is that they have come in, and to your point, really, it is the sign of a sicker marketplace, because it really isn't balanced correctly for what we know historically is really in the best interest of a long-term growing market, which is that you have a lot of first-time buyers, and you've got a lot of trade-up buyers, and you have a teeny-tiny slice of percentage of cash buyers and investors who, like 6% to 8%, which is what it should be as opposed to what it is now, which is still like in the 20-something percent range. Darren Blomquist, thank you so much for being with us again. We appreciate the insights, and we love having you on the show. You'll have to come back.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right. Darren Blomquist is a vice president with Realty Track. You can find out more at RealtyTrack.com, or just check out thinklink.com in today's show notes, and we'll put a link there as well. I'm Elise Glink. We're Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours. Stay tuned. Be back in a moment with more on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on anytime at ClarkHoward.com, and midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on 95.5 FM and AM 750 News Talk WSB.
everybody, to the Elise Point Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. So last week on the show, I had a number of calls from people who were saying, hey, I don't understand this. My credit score is actually falling, even though I'm paying off debt, and I don't, you know, my credit card situation hasn't changed. I still have a mortgage. I don't understand. I was at 780, I was at 810, and now I'm at 750. And I thought, well, our next guest is the right person to answer those questions. Anthony Sprav is the Senior Consumer Credit Specialist and Director of PR for FICO, which is Fair Isaacs, which is the company that created the credit score. So who better to talk about what is going on and some of the changes than Anthony. Anthony, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
It's nice to have you. So it was really interesting. We had a call from somebody, and they said, you know, I don't understand this. I went to go get a loan, and I was told that because of the new Fannie Freddie regulations, my credit score went down. And I thought to myself, those two things have nothing to do with each other. But then we heard from three or four other people who also said they'd previously been at 800 or 810. Nothing much had happened other than they were paid off credit cards or debt was paid off. And their credit score also fell to 730, 750, 760. So what's going on with that?
Yeah, that's hard to say without knowing more specifics. But the first thing I would ask is, are they checking their FICO score or are they looking at an educational score? And so if they weren't looking at the same score over time, there could be a difference between those scores. The FICO score is used in 90% of the lending decisions in the United States, so it is the score to know. Educational scores are beneficial.
Well, what is an educational score? Why don't you talk about what that is?
Those are scores that are sold by a variety of outlets that are not the score that a lender is using to make a lending decision. The score that is most often used to make a lending decision is the FICO score. So it really is important that someone is looking at their FICO score. And you can get your FICO score at myfico.com. And so that might be where there was a difference in that they were looking at different scores versus their FICO score. Because typically, if you're paying down your debt, that is going to improve your credit and not hurt your credit score.
All right. So let me ask a couple of questions about that. So I know that Discover Card is now promoting its IT card, and soon I hear from Discover people at in their communications department, all people who have a Discover Card are going to be able to get their FICO scores. Is this the same FICO score you're referring to?
Absolutely, and that's part of the FICO Score Open Access Program. We're working with lenders like Discover and other credit card companies right now to make the same FICO score that they're using to manage a consumer's account available to the consumer. So it's the most relevant FICO score that they can get. It's the exact same score that Discover is using to manage their account, to extend their credit, or make any other decisions about their credit account.
Now, when people go to buy a house or get a car, there's a different FICO score that they would get that is not one that you sell directly to consumers, right? There's like a FICO house score and a FICO car score.
Potentially. So there are variations on the FICO score that certain lenders use for perhaps auto lending or mortgages. But those variations are based on the same mathematical algorithm. And so if you're looking at what we call the base score, and your lender is looking at perhaps a mortgage score or an auto lending score, the score is going to be a very slight difference between those two scores because it is based on the same mathematical formula.
And when you say slight difference, what do you mean by that?
What it's doing is it's putting more weight on your history in terms of if you've had a car loan or if you've had a mortgage before. So it's evaluating components in your credit history and putting a little bit more weight on those components. The exact difference is hard to say because that's going to vary by individual, but it's not going to be a significant difference.
Okay.
If you're managing and focusing on your base FICO score and doing all the right things to improve that score, such as paying all of your bills on time, keeping your revolving credit balances low, and only opening new credit when necessary, that score will be a good score, and any other FICO score will be a good score.
Right. So the education scores that get used, now Vantage is a score that's not a FICO score, correct?
Correct.
Okay. But there are others as well that different, the credit reporting bureaus are concocting?
There are some that are offered by the credit reporting bureaus. There are others that are offered by different websites that are out there that advertise and market themselves as selling credit scores. So, yes.
Okay, and you call those education sites. What about
right.
the ones that we, and the CFPB is cracking down on this, but the whole free mm-hmm. score thing. I mean, Credit Karma offers a free score. You have free score, freecreditscore.com. There's all kinds of free scores that are running around, but that is not the FICO score.
No, that is not the FICO score.
Okay. So one of the things that you guys have created recently is this High Achiever infographic. And when you talk about high achievers, you think, you're thinking about people who have scores in the 600s to the 800s, but 800s is what I think of as high achievers. What do you think about?
So really, a high achiever is anybody with a FICO score of 750 or above. At 750 or above, you're going to get the best interest rates that are available and the best offers that are available. And so, you know, we try to not have people obsess about getting a perfect FICO score, but if you're above 750, that's what we consider a high achiever, and that's about 37% of the U.S. population that have FICO scores.
Now, on your own website in the education section, I believe that you kind of graph out, or at least have a different chart, and I think the top score that you look at is either 760 or above or 780 or above. Is that right?
I'm not sure off the top of my head, but...
Okay, well, I know that different lenders think that 780 is
right.
sort of there and above is their high
right.
score. Others think
right.
760. You're now talking about 750. All of that's a little bit confusing for people. Why did you pick 750?
750 is what, from our experience working with lenders, that's where people, lenders typically are providing the best rates at 750 or above.
Okay. And what do you find for the high achievers when you look at kind of facts about them? What did you find when you were putting together your infographic?
So what we find is that people with the best FICO scores have a long account history. On average, they have credit that they've had for 11 years. So the average age of a credit card account for a high achiever is 11 years old. That speaks to having a good, robust history and managing that history well over time. We also find that with high achievers, they are keeping their balances low. So the average balance on their credit cards is $8,500. What we like to advise people is to keep your balances on revolving credit at 30% or less of your available credit, so that at any given time, you're only utilizing 30% of your available credit. People that are struggling or have lower FICO scores typically are maxing out their cards or carrying higher balances and have less available credit. So you really want to work at keeping your balances low, because that credit utilization accounts for 30% of the FICO score.
Okay, so one of the things, we talk about that all the time. So what you're really saying is if you have a $10,000 limit, you really don't want to have a balance of any greater than $3,000. If
correct.
You need to carry a balance of that's greater than that, instead of putting it on one card, you're better off splitting it to two cards.
You're better off splitting it to two cards, but you know, life happens, and there are moments where you may have to spend more for an emergency, new appliance, or something like that. And if you do find that your balance has crept up over that threshold, you should be focused on bringing it down as quickly as possible. I mean, credit scores are meant to be fluid, so, you know, you don't want people to obsess about, oh my God, my balance is too high, I'm going to FICO score purgatory. You know, it's just a guideline, and so you really want to keep an eye on your balances, do your best to keep those balances low, understanding that things happen and you may have to go up, but if that happens, you focus on bringing it down as quickly as possible.
Right. So It's interesting, as we continue to develop in the digital economy, there has been so much more on identity theft and all this stuff going on. You know, just we just have a minute or so left. Any thoughts about how to protect your identity? You know, your FICO credit score certainly depends on your credit history, and that is really at risk with all of the, you know, the information on the Target breach and the Neiman Marcus breach and the Michael's Craft Shop breach and all the others.
Yeah, I think the best thing people can do is to continually monitor their credit accounts, and that means what, you know, what rhythm works for you, whether that's once a week. Some people do it every day. Some people do it every month. But it really is looking at your transactions on your credit cards to make sure that those are your transactions and there's not something on a credit card that you don't recognize. With online banking, mobile banking, it's super easy to do that. There are also monitoring services that you can use to sort of keep an eye on what's going on your account. A lot of the major credit card companies have some great automatic monitoring programs based on, you know, what your typical pattern of spending is. But, you know, owning it yourself, it's really like taking, like I, for example, take a few minutes every morning, quickly scan through my credit cards to see what transactions are on there. Yes, they're the ones I made over the last day or two. Boom, we're out.
Yeah. Anthony Sprav is FICO Senior Consumer Credit Specialist, Director of PR. Hey, thanks so much for being with us today.
Glad to help out.
All right, I appreciate that. You can find out more at myfico.com. I'm Elise Glink. Stay tuned. I'll be back in a moment with more of the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time on News Talk WSB.
Find your expert advice anytime at thinklink.com and find Elise Glink live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750 News Talk WSB.
Everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Just want to remind you, at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K, and we will be tweeting out everybody's email address and all the websites from today. Really interesting information. I just have to say, the two book authors we had last hour, Adam Bryant and Jay Dobbins, these are such special books. If you're looking for something that's a great read, I recommend both of them highly. Adam Bryant's book, if you're a small or medium-sized business owner, it is chock full of great advice that is going to, I think, change a little bit on how you operate. I know I'm already taking some messages to heart as well. And if you're looking for a way to place, to find that courage deep down inside, Jay just has remarkable stories in his book as well. Go to thinklink.com. We're going to have it all up in the blog. Make sure you sign up for the free weekly newsletter while you're there. It comes out Mondays and Thursdays. And we have just great information coming out and a whole bunch of really cool stories on thinklink.com. I hope you have a great week. It is time for me to go off and travel and do all the other things that I'm doing this week, run my business, write my syndicated columns, and of course I'll be back here next Sunday at 11 for the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Have a great week, everybody.